Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Wayne McIntosh in this episode. Wayne is founding director of the OER Foundation and coordinator of the OERU, and he's a rich background in computing, teaching, education, and distance learning. We talked via Skype, me in Lower Hutt and Wayne in Dunedin, New Zealand. It gives me great pleasure to be talking with Dr. Wayne McIntosh, founding director of the OER Foundation and coordinator of the OERU, an international innovation partnership which aims to widen access to more affordable education for all. Wayne, it's great to be talking with you. You are indeed a leader in online education.
Thank you very much, Mark, for the invitation to join you. I mean, it's just great to be able to connect in this way.
Wayne, can we begin with a brief overview of career and publications?
So I guess the best place to start is in the beginning. I kind of landed in the open distance learning field, or in particular the technology-enhanced learning and components of what we do, somewhat by accident. In my first life, I trained as an accountant, but while I was doing my articles, I realized this was not something I would be able to do for 40 years of my life. And I changed over to education, which was the best decision I ever made. First trained as a secondary school teacher, got my postgraduate diplomas in teaching and onto a master's degree. And I wanted to make a shift to higher education, become a lecturer at a university. And I was offered a position at the University of South Africa, which as many folk will know, UNISA was the first single mode distance teaching university of the world. Having started teaching at a distance back in 1946. But the position I was appointed to was to teach a postgraduate course in computer-assisted learning, or, back in the day, CBT, and this is long before the days of the internet. And I guess the only reason I got the job, apart from having some postgrad qualifications in sort of education, was the fact that I actually knew how to use a computer. And I completed one semester course in mainframe COBOL programming. But there weren't many folk around, certainly in teacher education, that had, basic literacies in using a computer. So the learning curve was steep in the beginning, but that's kind of how I got into distance education. I remember fondly, we were in those days working with fourth generation programming languages. At the university, there wasn't a computer on everybody's desk. There would have been like four or five computers for the whole faculty to use. And this particular software, these were the days when the graphic user interfaces were starting to come in. And this particular software that we're using, would support design for users to use a mouse. And in those years, I had to write a special memorandum requesting the purchase of a mouse in order to be able to teach this program. So, that was kind of like an interesting introduction to the whole world of, sort of technology-enhanced learning. Shortly, I was, at the university for maybe 2 years or so, and I was then appointed as coordinator of what was then the largest course in the University of South Africa. It was a foundation course in education, a first-year-level course in education. And at the time, we had 12,000 learners that were registered for the course. And you'll see the connections later, because in the early days of, the first MOOCs that came about, people were talking about, about these massive open online courses and, 2,500, 3,000, 4,000 learners. It was trying to understand the massification bit in this piece. We were teaching programs with 12,000 learners, granted still with legacy correspondence forms of delivery. But in those years, the pass rates were not that high, and we introduced a simple innovation, and that was, under the old system, learners would complete two assignments, essay-type assignments, in order to get enough credits to get examination entrance to the challenge exam on which they would pass or fail. And what we did was develop an interactive print-based workbook, which is certainly not revolutionary by any means. And anyone that has been involved in sort of learning design will know, well, if you actually get the learners to work through the materials, there's a better chance of them passing. And this is basically what we did. I mean, the workbook required the learners to actually work through the materials. And we had a radical increase in the pass rate, almost doubling the pass rate in that year that we implemented that. And the usual questions, you've lowered the standards because, you know, it's not possible to achieve these higher pass rates and that sort of thing. But I guess those are the foundations that really triggered my interest in open distance learning or distance education as a form of delivery. Back in the day, I was involved with co-leading the development of the first postgraduate qualification in Africa in open distance learning. When we had completed that program, there was an interesting initiative or partnership between the then University College at the University of Maryland and Oldenburg University in Germany that actually ran, certainly in the field of open distance learning, one of the first online sort of professional development initiatives in the discipline of open distance learning. And I joined that online professional development workshop, not because I wanted to learn about open distance learning. I mean, at that stage, I was pretty well versed in the theory, literature, and research, but because two of the leading theoretical thinkers at the time were actually moderating two of the weeks in this professional development program. And the one was Börje Holmberg from Sweden, and the other was Otto Peters. And I joined this online professional development exercise, and it was just a crude discussion forum. You know, a paper would be distributed, and then there would be a couple of kind of discussion board posts. But I joined that purely to be able to interact and meet these leaders of, you know, distance education.
Mm. I can hardly blame you for doing that, actually, Wayne. It's certainly an opportunity that you couldn't overlook.
But at the same time, it shows the power of the medium, right? That you were able to connect with these heroes in the theoretical development. And I was fortunate enough many years later to actually meet both of those scholars in person. But it's an interesting connection because the work of Otto Peters has been a significant foundation in my own thinking and you know, the work that I've been doing. Otto Peters was one of those scholars who was largely misunderstood by a large component of, you know, the theoreticians working in the space. You know, I mean, the association of the industrialization of teaching with smoking factories and all the rest of it is the kind of thing that doesn't go down well with the average educator.
Of course, he was only observing, wasn't he? Just describing what he saw. So he wasn't suggesting that it should be that way.
Absolutely. And what few people actually know is how rigorous his work actually was. I mean, he went through a whole observation period, you know, which lasted a good number of years. And then he commenced with a theoretical analysis and actually looking from different theoretical perspectives. So in good German traditions, there was a didactic analysis, there was a sociological analysis, there was a historical analysis. And after he completed all these analyses, came to the conclusion that distance education was sui generis. Using the Latin term, you know, being of its own kind. You think about it, single mode distance education in an organized form did not exist before the Industrial Revolution. And in part that was due to, you know, the availability of technologies of mass postal services and the printing press. One wouldn't have been able to deliver distance education before the onset of the Industrial Revolution. But that raises a number of interesting questions, of course. If one buys into the theory of discontinuity, and I'm not a sociologist, it raises, you know, interesting questions from the perspective of there was life before the Industrial Revolution. There was a new form of education that evolved because of the Industrial Revolution. And if the knowledge society or information society or the fourth Industrial Revolution or whatever label wants to attach to it is a fundamentally new form of society, the interesting question, of course, is will we see new forms of education emerging? It's that kind of thinking that has driven a lot of the work that I've done, over the years, thinking about, well, you know, if this knowledge and information society is a new epoch, will we see new forms of education emerging? And I'm not sure I have the answers to that question, but nonetheless, it's worthwhile contemplating.
So you've had a really fascinating background. So computer programming, education, instructional design, certainly a strong theoretical basis in OFDL. You've name-dropped a few very, very core founding fathers of distance education there. Clearly, your work is going to be shaped in a particular direction. I wonder if you can just give us a bit of an oversight as to the sorts of things you've done over the years following that time that you've just talked about.
One of the interesting aspects, which has also helped a lot in my understanding, even now in the future, is back when I was still at UNISA, I was tasked with the re-engineering of the institution's development, design, production, and delivery processes. And in those years, UNISA was operating, which was then the largest printing press under one roof in the Southern Hemisphere.
Gosh.
Just given, you know, the size of the operations. And part of the challenges the institution was experiencing as they were implementing significantly improved pedagogies with the delivery of their courses, which had significant implications for how the study guides were printed because of, you know, new layouts, new designs, it was less standardized. There were huge bottlenecks that were occurring within the printing presses, because around the cost efficiencies of having print runs that are large enough to print cost effectively. And I was involved with the introduction of the first two industrial strength, high resolution print on demand printers. And in those years, the Docutech technology. And already, you know, the signs were becoming clear of the significant role technology would be playing in the future of education delivery in terms of cost efficiencies, because you were able to print large or medium print runs far cheaper through digital technologies, which then actually alleviated the bottlenecks on the large offset printers.
Yeah.
In order, you know, getting, you know, course materials, you know, out on time and all the rest of it. So that informed quite a bit of thinking, and not only thinking about technology in terms of our delivery, but also how technology influences sort of the design and development side of things. And back in the early days, in those years, I was introduced to free and open source software, and which was a fascinating field, which offered a number of opportunities for large institutions to become more cost effective. And that's where my interest in the whole free and open source software movement were first introduced. And, you know, I can recall one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. And that was when I was presenting to an audience of free and open source software developers, using, of course, an open source software application, OpenOffice, you know, the presentation software, but still running it on a proprietary operating system.
Right.
But, you know, of course, it wasn't a problem because the audience would say, oh, he's using OpenOffice, he's part of the family. But as it happened, the projector crashed and we had to reboot the projector. And then the folks saw I was using a Microsoft operating system. And that is when I realized I was, you know, actually being this total fraud, advising institutions at the enterprise level of the merits and values of using free and open source software. And that is where I made the migration to not using any proprietary software at all, and which has been particularly useful and helpful in the work that I'm doing now with the OER Foundation, because we run the entire entity based entirely on free and open source software. And that kind of gives a very interesting perspective, because we have no organizational reliance on proprietary software. And so it gives us insights into opportunities and shortcomings of using an entirely open source model for, you know, building the future of education. So, I mean, that has been an incredibly valuable experience.
So, Wayne, you could almost be described as an open radical, couldn't you? So there's a real openness about everything that you do, and it informs all of your practice.
Absolutely, but I want to qualify radical. Radical as in terms of radix, the root, the foundation, as opposed to being a zealot. I think there's a subtle difference.
Absolutely.
But yeah, radical in terms of really pursuing the foundations of openness, you know, as we move forward. And I mean, we can look at the history of our field in terms of how it's evolved. You know, 1946, University of South Africa, first distance teaching institution. 1969, the foundation of the British Open University, who were the pioneers of the team approach to course design and development. In the 80s, we saw the growth around unpacking open learning as a philosophy, and the debates that ensued around, you know, what this openness really means. Also around about the same time, you know, the late 80s was when free and open source software really started coming onto the scene. Early 2000s, you know, open licensing, you know, with the introduction of the Creative Commons licensing suite, UNESCO's work in coining the term open educational resources, shifting on to open educational practices. You know, it's going to be interesting to see where the future might be going. And I think we have a couple of interesting times ahead of us. I mean, I think there are going to be some fundamental changes to the way that we do what we do. I think we're still in the very, very early phases of mainstream adoption of open education as a way of doing things. We certainly haven't reached the tipping point. Unlike the open access publishing movement, I mean, in certain regions of the world, today there are more open access journal publications than there are closed. Whereas in sort of open education, we are far from reaching the tipping point, you know, that the majority of courseware in open distance learning is actually assembled from open educational resources. So there's still a lot of work to be done. I mean, one way of labeling it, it is a battle in the sense of winning the hearts and minds of individuals, but it may also be a natural progression as well. I mean, I think it's this whole evolution versus revolution debate, which, as I get older, if you spoke to me 20 years ago, I might have had a different opinion. But, you know, as you mature, I think the whole evolution and revolution debate are two sides of the same coin. You know, lots of small change actually adds up to big change over time. And, you know, I think this is the way we need to move, because if we're looking for a more sustainable way of delivering education, there is no other solution than open education. I mean, there's no form of educational delivery that is more cost-effective, more scalable, or more sustainable than open education. And given the fiscal challenges that higher education is faced worldwide, you know, I think we've got to start thinking a lot more smarter about, you know, more sustainable ways of doing what we do.
So, Wayne, what are the missing pieces then? What do we need to unlock in order for open to achieve its potential?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think the best way of, you know, moving forward is actually doing it. Again, this whole many small steps result in big change. We need to move forward in doing it. All around the industrialized world, or certainly in most parts of the industrialized world, the cost of education to learners has increased far in excess of the inflation index. And that combined with decreasing investment from government in educational provision, and in part the success of the massification of education is having an impact on that as well, because, I mean, the more people that are having access to higher education, if we look at the hundreds of millions of learners who will not have the privilege of a tertiary education simply because, A, they can't afford it, or there are not enough seats available in their home country, we have got to find more effective ways of actually offering that education to the population. And I'm a firm believer that tertiary education is a public good. I firmly believe that both society and government has an obligation in terms of educating its populace. I don't believe it will function effectively as a privatized operation. I mean, if higher education behaved as a perfect market, we should see prices dropping, right? Because the demand is so great. But that's not happening. And, you know, education is fundamentally a public good. And, you know, we have got to get better at integrating, you know, open education approaches in what we do. And, you know, that has to be an open-first approach, which we espouse at the OER University. So because we base everything we do on free and open source software. And you know, that's driven by a principled approach. No learner should be required to have to purchase a proprietary software license in order to engage in learning. And this is not about, it's about respecting freedom of choice. It's about respecting decisions of individuals. It's not about saying people shouldn't be using proprietary software, but we shouldn't be demanding of those who can't afford it to be actually using proprietary models. And we have, strong prototypes and demonstrators to show that we can do this. We can provide open online courses at no cost to the learner. We can do it.
Yeah, I think the OER textbook movement would say the same thing, that you can get good quality for free.
I mean, the open textbook movement has been quite significant in terms of raising awareness and attention, particularly to the plight of learners around affordability. But it's a thin edge of the wedge. The cost of textbooks in terms of total cost to learner is most probably about 10% of the total cost of study.
Yeah.
So, I mean, while these advances are important for reducing cost and effectiveness and efficiency, it's only part of the problem. We've demonstrated a model where we can provide, high quality education based entirely on OER for roughly 25% of the comparable cost of tuition. So one simple move that a government can make in any country, not just New Zealand, is to mandate open licensing of all education materials produced by taxpayer dollars. And, you start incentivizing the use of open and disincentivizing the use of proprietary content. Because if you do that, if one is going to work with proprietary content, well, you're going to have to fund it yourself. It's your cost. But if we mandate, and New Zealand has been a leader with the New Zealand government open access licensing framework, with all government departments and crown agencies being required to release content under the most permissive license, and a strong encouragement for school boards of trustees. I mean, one way we can make open education sustainable in New Zealand is extending the NZ Gold framework to tertiary education. And that doesn't cost money. It's a change in the act.
That's right. And overnight, it would mean New Zealand becomes basically an open education nation.
Yeah. And then we need to start collaborating with each other. I mean, any open source software developer worth their salt, when tackling a new project, the very first thing that he or she will go and do is go and see what code is already available that I don't need to reinvent in order to complete the task that I'm doing. And similarly, I mean, if we remove that competitive element through open content because we are forced to use it, we will go out and find the bits of content that are relevant to what we're doing. Hopefully we'll see, greater impetus in, mandating, open licensing, for essentially something that's a public good. I am concerned about the sustainability of higher education. I'm not part of the bandwagon that is, preaching disruptive innovation in education. I mean, I think part of that is a myth. Because universities have been around for a long time. I mean, they survived the Industrial Revolution, and I think they're smart enough to survive deeper in the future. But I do think we are going to see significant shifts in the way that we operate in order to become more sustainable and more effective. It's around the use of open. I think we are going to see arguably more decentralization. I mean, if we look at how the internet has evolving, and the disillusionment of, the big corporates in, generating these walled gardens to try and enclose the internet, and the risks that are associated with that, I suspect that we will see greater decentralization, certainly at a technological level. The emergence of new forms of credentialing. I mean, there's the thinking that's happening around alternative digital credentials, and how we can better transition between those forms of credentialing and more traditional modalities, I think are areas where I would like to see a lot more thought and thinking going into. Because we get this right, we are able to sustain education as a public good, as opposed to, throwing the ball away, having the corporate providers take over the space. I mean, I think that is a a substantive risk for education in its original meaning.
So would that be building on the current scholarship around micro-credentialing and badging, more perhaps towards more substantial educational qualifications?
I think it's both. It's around that mapping and how alternate forms of digital credentialing might actually lead to traditional forms of education certification. I mean, given the changes that we're seeing in employment as well, and what developments in technology might mean for the employment market, I mean, clearly there's going to be a greater need for lifelong learning. And we need to have more flexible ways in which learners can credential themselves in ways that are meaningful to employers. Because ultimately, I mean, I think the end game is, the token value of any credential, whether it's a micro-credential or a traditional degree or diploma, is ultimately determined by the employers in terms of what value they place on those credentials. And, historically, employers have placed a high value on university credentials and polytechnic credentials because they have trust in the system, right? They know what they're getting with those credentials. But how long that is going to survive into the future is an open question. Given the amazing technologies we have at our disposition to be able to disaggregate, to decentralize, to do things in smarter, more efficient ways, we should be exploring it for the future of education as a public good, in my view.
Wayne, you've mentioned a few names already in the classic distance education space. Are there some people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, some folk whose work or perspectives has significantly influenced you, or perhaps some folk who you think otherwise have very important perspectives to share?
Sure. If I may, I'd like to suggest four names who have been pretty close to the work that we've been doing here at the OER Universitas. First off, I'd like to suggest Emeritus Professor Jim Taylor at the University of Southern Queensland, who many in the open distance learning field will be familiar with. Jim is one of the co-thought leaders in the establishment of the OERU. And I suggest having a conversation with Jim about the pedagogy of discovery, or what he has called free-range learning, and what OER can enable in this space. I'd also like to suggest Mary Burgess, who is executive director at BC Campus in British Columbia, who have been doing amazing work around open education, in particular the open textbook movement in reducing cost for learners. Mary's work is interesting in the sense that she puts pedagogy first, putting the learners right at the center of the process. And it would be good to have a conversation with Mary around open education and the pedagogical aspects in this space. Another leader I'd like to suggest is Professor Sandra Wills, who's now semi-retired, previously from Charles Sturt University. Sandra has a very long career and is a pioneer of multimedia and distance education in Australia.
Excellent.
Lastly, I'd like to suggest Dr. David Porter, who is Chief Executive Officer at eCampus Ontario. An interesting focus for a conversation with David would be the work that they've been doing around micro-credentialing and open education.
Brilliant. Well, Wayne, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. You have an inspirational vision, and I know you work incredibly hard on behalf of the OERU to bring more open education to all. I sincerely wish you well as you continue on that great work.
Thank you very much, Mark. I'm very privileged to be able to spend my full working day living out my passion. It's a great privilege, and thank you for the opportunity in joining the conversation.
Brilliant. Thanks, Wayne.
You can learn more about Wayne and his work from our website. His Twitter handle is MacIWG.
That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.